something just about everyone who knows me well knows about me, that I hate smartphones. And I don't even think I could tell you exactly where the hatred comes from, because of course I acknowledge all the ways they make my life easier, which is something I'm usually all about. But something about them, I don't know. I hate them. It's visceral. But if you're wondering if I still have one, yes. I haven't been able to get away from it, and I'm not proud of it, but I'll admit it, I'm hooked. My name's Tobin Richardson. I'm a counselor educator with the vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. And here, exploring the topic of phone addiction, which is something I've been somewhat borderline obsessed with lately. I'm currently reading the book The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, and it's supporting an instinct I've already had for a while, which is that in a macro way, as a society, smartphones are really detrimental to our mental health. Stephen Kurtze is a journalist, and he wrote a book about this area in the United States where, due to the military conducting scientific research, radio transmissions are restricted by law, and that includes Wi-Fi. And that no Wi-Fi part, it piqued my interest right away when I found out about it. I had to know more. In the face of this whole area is this town called Green Bank, West Virginia, which houses this major astronomical observatory. And Stephen, like me, was fascinated about what this means for the people who live there. So he went there and wrote about it. Here he is.
I went there because I myself don't have a cell phone. I haven't owned a cell phone since 2009. Like, starting to wonder, am I the only one out there who doesn't have a cell phone? So most people have smartphones. Is there anyone like me out there? So did like a search, like places without cell phone service or places where people don't have cell phones. And the first thing that pops up is Green Bank, West Virginia. So that turned into me going there and living there for like 4 months, trying to find out what life was there, like there, if there were any lessons from that place to bring back to my own life or to the, you know, the quote unquote, the outside world. So Green Bank is very much like the public facing aspect of the Quiet Zone. But the real force behind the Quiet Zone is this defense department, this like national security agency apparatus that's there. There's a state law called the West Virginia Radio Astronomy Zoning Act. And that law mandates that within a 10-mile radius of any radio astronomy facility, there's additional rules. There's additional rules of quiet.
The dynamic of Green Bank is really interesting because to me as a small town, I think it is like, you could use that as a marketing campaign. To me, there are a lot of people who like the idea of being off the grid and getting off the grid.
It's funny you mentioned the marketing aspect because like I had that conversation with like the head of the tourism for the county and me saying to her, like, would you ever just market this place as come here for the quiet, come to the quiet zone, come to get away from it all? She's like, no, people don't want the quiet. We will never market the fact that we are a quiet zone. And there's often a sense that the people who live there all the time, they're not choosing it. It's just, it's kind of been forced upon them a little bit. It's just like the geography that they're lived in. So they see it as an inconvenience and a hindrance. So there's a quiet zone, like patrol car. And it's this truck, which has like, I don't know, a couple dozen radio antennas sticking out the top. And they act as like a direction finding array. And they can, I did a couple drive arounds in that truck and it's kind of astonishing how much Wi-Fi is actually in the town. Like before you even get out of the observatory's parking lot, you're getting all kinds of bings and beeps telling you, here's Wi-Fi, here's Wi-Fi, here's Wi-Fi. And it's more the quiet zone cop, the patrolman, he's not stopping in every single house saying, hey, turn it off, hey, turn it off, hey, turn it off. He's more just taking a record of it so that they have a sense of how loud it is. And it's the reality now in Green Bank. There's so much Wi-Fi in the neighborhood already that they cannot do their radio astronomical measurements in that band.
So I guess even the quiet zone, you can't get away from it. It's kind of what I hear you saying. Like if you think that there's somewhere in America where you can be totally off the grid in that way, no.
And that's kind of like the end point of my book. It's like, look, the reality is that the quiet zone is not as quiet as the media makes it out to be. It's not as quiet as like it's not just the media. It's like the media has the story and we want to believe this story that it's quiet because for many of us, it's somehow satisfying. It's somehow, right? It's nice to know that there's someplace out there that's still quiet.
My takeaway from here is Green Bank, it's kind of like a Rorschach test. I wanted to believe in Green Bank. I so wanted to believe in Green Bank. And I think that says something about me. And the locals don't even want to market it as what it that the way it's so unique, you know? Up next, you'll hear from a therapist, Nicole Runyon, who's built this entire private practice around the notion that our relationships with our phones and technology in general, it's actually stifling us from living mentally healthy lives. She focuses mostly on the impact on first children, but then also on how that impacts families and everyone else as well. Nicole does a lot of coaching and speaking about how it doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to accept this. There's a way out. Here she is. You had to guess from your clinical experience, what percentage of Americans would you say are addicted to their phone?
I would imagine it's a very high percentage. Like it has to be in the 80s or 90s. And I will just, full disclosure, say that I'm addicted to my phone. I am a compulsive type A, want to get things done, task-oriented person. And my phone is like, central station. And if I can get things done, then I feel good. But I think that's why it has to be such a high percentage, because I think everybody has a like something on their phone that keeps them on it. I started seeing this around 2014 when the children started to get devices, mainly in middle school. And all of a sudden, I had an influx of middle schoolers in my practice, and they were coming in with really severe mental health symptoms. And part of seeing children is seeing their parents as well, and doing an extensive deep dive into their childhoods and their past, and maybe some root causes for why they have mental health issues. And while the families had some work to do and could use a little help, it didn't warrant the kind of severity of the symptoms I was seeing. And so I really dug deep and asked myself, well, what's going on with this cohort of children? Because at the time, I'd been practicing for 10 years seeing children, and I had never seen this kind of severity, with no root in any kind of trauma. And at the time, I really could, I pinpointed that it had to be the tech. And I watched it sort of spiral into when the devices first came on the scene. The schools had pretty good boundaries around, not allowing the children to be on them during the school day. But it more and more kids got devices, and then more reason to be on the devices, because then social media kind of took off during that time. And then they became addicted, and they had a hard time putting it down during the school day. So, what I watched happen, at least in my community with the cohort of kids I was seeing, was the school sort of just washed their hands of it and said, well, we can't control it. Pandora's box is open. What can we do? And then it just kept sort of getting worse and worse. So, it was very obvious to me, because I was seeing the dysfunction. I started talking about it in 2016, and nobody was talking about it in 2016. And so it's kind of interesting now that it's such a hot topic and such a, everybody's sort of on board with, yeah, it's affecting them. A lot of people aren't ready to make a change, but at least now we know it's affecting them.
That was probably hard, especially in 2016. How did you navigate that with parents? Because I think probably especially then they maybe didn't want to hear it, maybe still don't.
Yeah, so what I thought that would be the best route would be to start offering free talks in my community. And because I wanted it to be more of a broad message, I didn't want parents individually to think I was accusing them of something, or telling them they had to make a major change, and maybe they weren't ready to hear that. So I thought if I just talked to the community and educated them about child development and how I see this affecting child development and then their mental health, that maybe people would be more open individually to come and talk to me about their own kids, maybe if they're seeing some of these things. And it was pretty successful. You know, I think I really planted a seed in the community. Like I said, nobody else was talking about it. And I think parents instinctually, and I'm a parent myself, so I feel this too, we instinctually know this stuff is not good for our kids. So when I started talking about it, people were like, yeah, that's right. That's what I notice in my kid too. But to your point earlier, people weren't and still are not ready to make that change, which I find fascinating because I think we've experienced enough pain to need to make the change.
Why do you think, if the problem is pretty clear, where does the resistance come from?
Resistance comes from the inability of parents to experience their own discomfort when their children are uncomfortable. So since I started speaking about tech, I've really developed more of a sophisticated message to parents because the tech is just a modality. But the real problem is that because generationally, nobody has gotten what they needed from the culture of parenting, the pendulum swings from one end to the other. And now we have two generations of kids, well, three really, the millennials, and the millennials are adults now, Gen Z and Alpha, who all are being raised by parents who cannot bear the feeling of their children being unhappy.
So there's a whole spectrum. I'm like, in my head, there's the parents who don't set boundaries around anything because it's so uncomfortable. I feel like I've also seen parents who are willing to set boundaries around other things, food. I mean, like would never let their kids drink or smoke, but they really struggle with technology specifically. And I'm not sure if maybe that just for some reason, it looks to me like that boundary is harder in like the parents of teenagers that I know, but it sounds like that isn't the way you're actually seeing that this play out with technology specifically.
Yes, I think both are true. I think that you're right about technology, particularly because even if you are a parent that wants to have boundaries or does have boundaries, sometimes the teachers will say, well, they need a phone for, you know, for class. Or the coach will say they need to be on Discord, you know, because that's where we give all the information. Now I'm understanding, I think some sports teams are asking kids to get on Instagram to promote themselves and get more kind of attention for the sport or for the team. So yes, I think in that way, it is harder for parents to have boundaries around tech now. Because it's infiltrated every part of our lives. But still, like I say, the root issue, the root cause of that is the inability to be uncomfortable. So for example, like if my teenager's coach said he has to be on Instagram, I would say no. And whatever consequence ensues from that, I will have to live with that. And that will probably keep me up at night. And things like that have kept me up at night. But that's my cross to bear.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of a sacrifice is really hard for people right now. I'm not pointing the finger at kids and saying they're all bad. I think actually the opposite. they're all like innocent beings. And it's our job as the adults to protect them.
Yeah.
And not to want our cake and eat it too. We just can't have that right now when it comes to this. It's too unregulated. And it's, you know, I liken it to big tobacco, big food, big pharma. They're all in it for profit, right? They're not in it to really help anyone or heal anyone or you know, make the world a better place. They're in it to make money.
Do you have hope that the tide is turning in a way that may change in the future, where there could actually be controls that are effective
Yes and no. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't have hope that this could change. So of course I think it could change. The way I think it's going to change though is through the parents. I don't think government controls, regulation, you know, big tech just placating parents by saying, oh, we have age limits and you can't get on social media until you're 13. I mean, they're not, how can they prove you're 13? It's just literally a yes or no box. So yes, I'm hopeful, but I'm betting on the parents.
Another like counter argument I often hear is a concept of exclusion. Like, I don't think it's healthy for my kid to be excluded, and I feel like they will be if I limit their access to these devices. What can parents do to kind of mitigate that?
I think that what parents can do is help their kids learn skills to communicate effectively, to socialize, to like actually have one-on-one personal relationships and interactions with people. You might think that handing your child that device is going to keep them connected and feel included, but it actually does the opposite. It makes them feel lonely. We have a loneliness epidemic. Why? If we're so called connected through social media.
I want to make sure before we run out of time that I also am able to ask you about the way phone addiction or technology addiction in general presents across the lifespan, because I think there's so much focus on childhood addiction, understandably. But I wonder if you see this kind of like across adults and older adults, and maybe like how it may present differently. Is your advice different depending on age of client?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think this is absolutely affecting everyone. It's affecting marriages. It's affecting, you know, intimacy between couples. Just look around, go to a restaurant and look at a couple sitting at a table in a restaurant. 9 times out of 10, they're each going to be on their devices at least part of the time. So absolutely, I think it's a problem for everyone. You know, it prevents us from being present, fully present. Because even, you know, even the mere presence of a phone, if you're not on it, if it's in your pocket, if it's in your purse, it's distracting.
What do you think about a detox? Like, I've heard about like smartphone detox. Do you think that that's the right way or the best way to combat phone or technology addiction?
You know, I liken it that to like a diet. Which I don't like diets because it's not a lifestyle change. It's just a temporary fix. And you might get relief from it. Actually, you will get relief from it. Detoxes are great. You're going to be a different person or your kid's going to be a different person. But then what about after, right? You can't go back to where you were at before. Otherwise, you're going to have to do another detox and keep doing those. So it's the idea of, if you need a detox to reset, cool, that's great. But then when you reintroduce it, how are you going to have it in your life? Because that has to change. You can't go back to the other way. I think in therapy, you're, as the clinician, you're the one that's holding the space in the room, right? So what they're bringing you, you're holding that for them. And you're making sure that they dig deep into those feelings. So if they're bringing you surface level issues because of particularly the phone, then you would want to dig into what are they avoiding? What are they trying to escape in their life? And then exploring that with them, because that's really what's at the core of their technology addiction.
I've had this thought come up in my mind before, but just never actually really been motivated enough to go through with it. But the idea has been to go to a public place and somehow test to see how long it takes for people to get on their phones, even if they're in a setting where you think and hope that they'd be socializing. I wasn't sure if my phone hatred was jading my view of usage. Like, maybe people aren't really on their phones as much as it seems like they are to me. And I'm just exaggerating it in my head because of my own bias. And I felt like this was as good of time as any to test it out and document my findings. Enjoy.
Okay, I am sitting in a food hall. It is just after 10 a.m., so it's not that busy. I'm going to try an experiment where I have my eyes on probably like 5 different tables right now. And if anyone comes and sits down that is with someone else, so it can't be an individual, I'm going to start the clock when they sit down and see how long it takes before one person at the table starts looking at their phone. So more to come. All right, it's been a few minutes. Still nobody has come and sat at one of the tables with somebody else. I will say one of the things I'm realizing is that I'm very aware of the fact that I look creepy. Like, I'm trying not to look like I'm staring at people, which I think makes it feel like I'm weird and staring at people. So, wait, okay, so now that I'm back recording. So someone had been sitting at one of the tables on his phone by himself, so he didn't count. Another guy just joined him and literally just pulled out his phone, the second guy. So I think this one counts because now there's two of them there together. So observation 1, 3 seconds. Okay, another update. So the first thing I have to say is that I'm realizing to not feel so creepy. I keep getting out my phone. Like, that's my defense mechanism to help me feel like I'm like doing something. I don't know. I wasn't expecting that. Second update is that I got another observation in. It was a couple. They sat down with backpacks. So I turned on my timer because they didn't have phones out at the beginning. They sat there for about 90 seconds. Like, put something in their backpacks. I thought one of them was going to reach for a phone, and they didn't, and then they got up. Okay, here I'm reporting on another non-finding by the parameters of my study, but there's been this table of 4 very young people who were sitting at an adjacent table when I got here. So they're not part of my study per se, because I didn't see how long it took them to get on their phones. But I had noticed that 3 of the 4 of them for like a long time, like, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes at least, had all 3 been on their phones. There was one holdout who was eating, and he just gaped and got out of his phone. I was thinking, I wonder if he doesn't have one, because it was a really long time. The other 3 were just on theirs. And now he's on his too. So 4 people all sitting at a table together have not spoken in a long time. Okay, I've been sitting here a while now, and it's like really a lull. The dining hall has become pretty much empty. There have been several individuals come, which don't match the parameters of my study. But I can't help but say this. A lot of them are literally, like, have their phone in their hand as they sit down. It's like before they sit, they pull their phone out of their pocket, which I guess just makes sense. Like, maybe it's easier to get your phone out of your pocket while you're standing up. But I don't know. I didn't even think about that before. In my head, I thought there would be a sit down and a pulling out of the phone. So, super interesting. Okay, another update that is not about the original study, which is that I didn't expect this, but I am realizing I have my laptop and phone here, and I, like, can't stay off of them. I mean, I'm not writing anything about the study. It's really just because it's so uncomfortable to look out into this dining hall. I don't know if it's because there's fewer people here now or something, but I really feel like I'm staring and people are noticing, even though I also know that they're not. But anyways, I feel like I just like turned a mirror back at myself and like, wow, I can't stay off my devices either, kind of for no reason. Which, touche, universe, maybe I needed to know this about myself.
Now that I have a great excuse to be back in front of my devices, I'll wrap up with the consideration for some of the big picture practical strategies you can implement if phone addiction pops up within your practice. One of the biggest lessons for me from diving into this topic is that rarely do people present with a self-identified concern over their phone usage. And that's probably at least in part because our phones are so functional in so many ways. And so it's hard to parse out when their net impact turns the corner from making our lives better and easier to making them worse. But the latter is probably more common. Nicole often used the junk food analogy, which really resonated with me. Like, yes, junk food is awesome. I literally love Reese cups and they make me so happy. But also, do they? It's hard to know. So helping to build and incorporate mindfulness into a client's routine can make them more aware of usage patterns and things like triggers, which drive them to their phone, and then tracking the longer term impact of how that makes them feel, just to get better insight on all this. Otherwise, it can just be a pervasive cycle, maybe without even seeing it. With that being said, even cutting back on screen time is really hard. Like, I've tried it, you've probably tried it, and at least for me, I've failed over and over and over. Your clients may not really want to change their phone habits, in which case, they're probably not going to. Motivation essentially has to be within the client themselves. So when there's gray area or you think maybe they're ready, you may want to really lean into the basics of motivational interviewing. So more specifically, explore with an open mind the pros and cons of their phone use and be patient. Listen to their own reasons for change and then try to keep them talking about those. But the reality is most clients will know deep down when their phone usage is causing them problems. And if you can get them to admit it and talk about that in their own words, that's the most effective way to really prompt sustained change. Another theme that really seemed to recur throughout my exploration of the topic was addressing habitual phone usage with just finding other things to do. So like hobbies and interests and in real life social time away from a screen can become much more comfortable once the ball gets rolling. But stepping away at first can feel really scary. And so supporting clients through the initial attempt to get involved in a real life activity, that can just be huge. The other really good news is that there is a lot of information and resources and energy surrounding this topic in a way that just didn't exist even a few years ago. So that's another snowball. And who knows, maybe these snowballs of all types, they might really finally be able to turn the tide on this issue. And I really hope that's the case because I talked to a lot of people while I was investigating this topic, mental health providers as well as just regular people in my life. And it seems to me like there's really a feeling of defeat about this topic in a way that I'm not sure I've really seen much throughout my career in mental health. So many people said things like, yeah, it's bad, but it's just the way it is now. Or it's not good for us, but it's never going to change and we just have to accept it. It was almost like a surrender to something they wanted to fight against, but just didn't know how, didn't have the armor. And so I'm hoping that we as therapists, we can be the ones really leading that fight, helping to clear the terrain and prove that there is a way forward. We don't have to accept defeat, but wow, it will not be easy and it will not be convenient. There's never going to be an app for that.